The following is a recording of a live questions and answers session with Chris McCann that took place on Sunday, April 7th, 2013.
Hello and welcome in to eBible Fellowship Sunday afternoon questions and answers time, where you can interact with us with your questions and comments related to the Bible, and we'll try to respond as well as possible by going to the Bible. And now, with Sunday afternoon's questions and answers, here's Chris McCann.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to eBible Sunday afternoon online fellowship and our time of question and answer. And at this point, we are going to open up the room for your question or comment that you may have. And each person is invited to share whatever may be on your mind by contacting us in the ways that were outlined. If you're listening on Pal Talk, you can just enter it into the text and that'll be relayed to us in a room, or give us a call the numbers were given, I believe. And I'll try to respond as much as I can by turning to the Bible, as the Bible is the Word of God. Well, we're just going to begin. We don't have that long of a time together, so let's open up the room at this point and go to the first person on the phones. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon question and answer. Please, go ahead with your call.
Yes, good afternoon, brother. Concerning the verse in Psalm 37:16, a little that a righteous man hath is better than the riches of many wicked. I believe Habakkuk says something in the closing chapters of
Habakkuk 3.
Please. Yes, Habakkuk 3, verses 17 to 19. It's not saying a better is a little, but I think it might be saying better is nothing than to have Christ. I'm saying to have Christ is everything. So could you read that, please?
Habakkuk 3, verse 17. Although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall fruit be in the vines, the labor of the olive shall fail, and the field shall yield no meat. The flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls. Yet I will rejoice in Jehovah, I will joy in the God of my salvation. Jehovah God is my strength, and he will make my feet like hinds' feet, and he will make me to walk upon my high places, to the chief singer on my stringed instruments.
Yes, it seems to me saying, although the fig tree shall not blossom. I mean, that means you're looking for something, and neither shall the fruit be in the vines. You're looking for something. Bill was going to say, yet I rejoice. If those things happen or they don't happen, yet I rejoice in the Lord. So I'm thinking that maybe that would be also to say that better is a little righteous than, you know, the many riches of the wicked.
Well, the verse 17 and 18, it seems to point to the time when there is no fruitfulness, or in other words, God's judgment on the church, and following that, God's judgment on the world. The fig tree can be likened to Israel, but Israel in turn is a picture of the churches, and the olive tree definitely relates to the New Testament congregations. And so here the fig tree is not blossoming. There neither shall be fruit in the vines. The labor of the olive shall fail. The field shall yield no meat. And the flock shall be cut off from the fold. And this is the case since the end of the church age. There is no fruitfulness. No one's became saved since God ended the church age. And yet, despite this, the individual child of God can say, I will rejoice in the Lord, or in Jehovah. I will joy in the God of my salvation. We continue our relationship as an individual with God, even though the corporate outward representation of God's kingdom is cut off and experiencing judgment, or even if the world is no longer being fruitful. In a sense, God is no longer saving. Yet the individual believer continues to rejoice in that salvation that God has granted him.
Okay, thank you. I have two more things to ask you, please. Brother Cabin taught of the if Solomon was saved or not, and I was shocked when I heard that. But as I did further studying, it seemed to be correct. If we read what God is saying carefully, when He kept telling Solomon, "If you do this, if you do that, you shall, you know, have eternal life. But if you don't, then you'll be punished." And as we read, we saw that Solomon went and had many strange wives. He made many high places, and he did so many things that's contrary to God's word. But I want you to look at this verse here. I'm sorry, 1 Chronicles 28, verse 20. And there's a word there I want you to take a look at in that verse.
1 Chronicles 28:20 says, "And David said to Solomon his son, be strong and of good courage and do it. Fear not, nor be dismayed, for Jehovah God, even my God, will be with thee. He will not fail thee, nor forsake thee, until thou hast finished all the work for the service of the house of Jehovah."
Now, you hear what God just said, until.
Until.
Now, I'm wondering, until. You see, he will do this until. So is David, and it was just a picture of Christ at times, is he saying that there will come a time where God will forsake Solomon?
I think so. I think that's fits in with everything else we've learned about him. And you know, just think of the young boy king. I think it was Joash, mm-hmm. who was faithful all the days of the priest. Oh, what was his name? I can't remember the name of the priest, but an old priest, an old man, who basically kept him in line. And then that priest died at the age of 130. And that points 10 times 13, or the completeness of the end of the world when the church age came to an end after 13,000 years. And then that same king who was faithful all the days of Jehoiada the priest, he went astray and even slew one of the sons of Jehoiada the priest for daring to prophesy against him. And so that's the same idea, faithfulness until a point and until a task is carried out. And so it would seem to fit that verse you just gave, that I will not forsake thee until thou hast finished the work.
Okay, I'm sorry. I don't want to take up too much time, but this question was posed to me. I received a copy of an illustrated version of the characters in the Bible. And I know that I'm not supposed to have that, okay, but it was a gift to me. And I explained to the person who gave it to me, you know, lovingly, that we shouldn't have these things. But we never discussed it before, so that's why they gave me this gift, thought that would be good for me. But I explained to them very nice that we shouldn't have those things. But then a question was posed to me from someone else that, well, what if, okay, well, we know we're not supposed to sit on the wall and say, well, that's Christ. We're not supposed to. Because if that was truly Christ, we're supposed to bow down to that, but we don't bow down to that. So if we don't do it to Christ, well, then what if we make a picture of ourselves? Or what if we just then, if we don't do it, bow down to Christ, but we bow down, we can make a picture of Moses or maybe make a picture of Solomon. And I said, no, that's not correct. But I don't know how to explain that, because Mr. Cam explained that very well, that we're not supposed to have anything. So I want you to look at Exodus chapter 20, verse 4 and 5. Explain that for me, please.
Exodus 20, verse 4. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, Jehovah thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, Well,
They asked me, well, are we not supposed to have pictures of our families and stuff like that? So I couldn't explain that.
There's no problem with having pictures. God isn't saying that. He's talking about, first of all, a picture of himself. We're not to make any image of him, and that would include pictures of Christ. We're not to do that. That would be making a picture of God, and God forbids that. Nor should we have a picture of any other kind of God, Buddha or any kind of idol. That would be an abomination. That would be why would we want to do that when we only know there's one God and we only serve him? So this applies to any, in the religious realm, anything that should be worshipped as God. We would not want any image or picture. We do not want something to, we don't need it, and God prohibits it. We want nothing in that area, but to have a picture of a family or, yeah, I know that there's pictures of Jonah or pictures of David or pictures of Bible characters. And that may not be the wisest thing, but that's not what God is prohibiting here. He's saying we're not to make any image of God, not to make any image to fall down to. He's not commanding us not to make any image, period, but just not to make any image of God.
Okay, bro. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your questions in those verses. And let's go to the next person on the phone. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon question and answer. Please go ahead with your call.
Yes. Hello, Chris. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yes, we can. Please go ahead.
I enjoyed today's study in the Psalm 37. And I had two questions for you. One was, you mentioned in the question and answer, I think last week, regarding God not breaking the supernatural until the very end, the very last day. And then I thought I heard something about Job, where Job was actually, Job actually, God did stop everything and then discussed with Job in those later chapters, exactly what this test was about. You know, it wasn't about really Job, it was about between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of Satan. And the question I had was, do you think, or do you see in any studies so far, that we, as we go through these remaining 1600 days, and we're almost past the 600 mark already, do you think that God will break the supernatural before the last day, whenever that is? And the second question I had regarded a verse in 2 Kings.
Well, let me answer that first one first. No.
Okay.
No, God will not break the barrier of the supernatural. There's no indicator of that anywhere in the Bible. And in Job, he was able to do it because the Bible wasn't completed, and he was still bringing revelation to men in that way of appearing to them or talking with them. But the Bible is completed in our day, and we can be sure that that this test will go all the way to the end, that it will go to the very last day. Now, if God could, which he can't, break the barrier of the supernatural, that would be revealing himself in a way that would go contrary to the whole idea of the test.
Yeah, that's what I figured, and I understood that, but I just was a little confused because I cut into the question. I heard the question incorrectly or only part of the question, so that's why I said, oh, I better ask about that, because I didn't think that would happen until, you know, everything was said and done and the test was complete, you know. But thank you for answering that. And the second question I had regarded 2 Kings, if you would examine chapter 1, verses 10 through 13 to compare with Zechariah chapter 13, verse 8 and 9.
Okay. 2 Kings chapter 1, beginning in verse 10. And Elijah answered and said to the captain of 50, "If I be a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume thee and thy 50. And there came down fire from heaven and consumed him and his 50. Again also he sent unto him another captain of 50 with his 50. And he answered and said unto him, O man of God, thus hath the king said, come down quickly. And Elijah answered and said unto them, If I be a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume thee and thy 50. And the fire of God came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. And he sent again a captain of the third 50 with his 50. And the third captain of 50 went up and came and fell on his knees before Elijah and besought him and said unto him, O man of God, I pray thee, let my life and the life of these 50 thy servants be precious in thy sight. And we see that there was three captains and three groups of 50 men, and that would total 153. And we also see that two of the three groups were destroyed by fire. And it's only the third group, the third captain and his 50, that are spared. And you want to compare this with Zechariah 13?
Yes, verse 8 and 9.
Zechariah 13, verse 8. And it shall come to pass that in all the land, saith Jehovah, two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third shall be left therein. And I will bring the third part through the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. They shall call my name, and I will hear them. I will say, it is my people. And they shall say, Jehovah is my God.
I just wanted to point out that the first set of verses in 1 Kings, fire was used and it destroyed two-thirds. I presume that would be of the world, but it could also be of the churches that weren't saved too. But I think it's of the world, and the third is the talking about the election or the God's people will go through the fire. Whereas in Zechariah, it doesn't seem like that fire is used on the third part, but not on the other two parts.
I'm sorry, can you say that last part again?
Sure, I'm trying to put the right words on this. The fire was used in the First Kings verses, and it destroyed two-thirds. The first two groups were destroyed by the fire, and the third group did not have to go through the fire because the angel of the Lord said, Elijah, go with the third captain. So the fire wasn't brought down. But then in Zechariah, we see that the first two groups weren't even, the Lord says, I'm going to bring the third through the fire after he had cut off the first two. So I'm just looking at, in the one, fire isn't used on the third. On Zechariah, it is used on the third, but not the first two-thirds.
In other words, they
were consumed, and I keep thinking of the book of Daniel where the three are in the oven and with the Son of Man and with Christ in there, and they went through without us harm to them at all.
Well, the fire can be destructful. It can destroy, or the fire can be something that purges, and it depends on whether someone is one of God's elect or not. And it's the same idea in 1 Corinthians 3, where it says in verse 12, now if any man build upon this foundation gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, stubble. So we have the elements, gold, silver, precious stones, and then wood, hay, stubble. Now, it's based, the fire will either destroy or purify based on the type of material. And if someone has gold, silver, precious stones, the fire will not burn them up, but it will purify. If someone, spiritually speaking, is wood, hay, stubble, they will be consumed because that's the nature of those materials. They cannot withstand fire. And so God goes on to say, every man's work shall be made manifest, for the day shall declare it, because it shall be revealed by fire, and the fire shall try every man's work of what sort it is. So in one sense, we could say this is judgment day, and judgment in the Bible is constantly associated with fire. So this is the day of fire, is another way of saying it's judgment day. And every human being, and like I was saying, I don't know if we still have the caller on, but judgment day is basically a day of fire. Everyone in all the world is put to this fire. And it depends on what we are spiritually. If God has saved us, we're gold, silver, precious stones, and the fire will not destroy us, but it will be as a fiery trial, and it will be a purging and purifying, and we will come forth through the fire to the glory of God. On the other hand, for most people in the world, the overwhelming number of people in the world are not saved, and the fire of the day of judgment will destroy them. It will burn them up. The fact that God has shut the door or put out the light of the gospel to the world has already sealed their fate. It has pronounced the judgment. It's just a matter of it being carried out. And so this is a day of punishment to every unsaved individual, and yet it is a day of trying and testing to every saved person. And it's only because of our spiritual condition that determines whether we're being punished or whether we're being tested. The fire is lit and is burning. The anger of God is hot against all the unsaved people of the earth. And it is this fire that that Zechariah 13 speaks of, that the believers, the third part, the elect, go through. And yet we could look at the fire in 2 Kings 1, and two-thirds are burned up, and the one-third there is not said to go through the fire, but they're spared, they're delivered from the fire. So in a sense, even though we're going through a fiery trial, we have been delivered from the fire that consumes, the fire that devours and destroys. That kind of fire we have been delivered from. So let's go to the next person on the phones. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon question and answer. Please, go ahead with your call.
Hi. I'd like just to make sure I have a correct understanding. My understanding about the end of the church age is that it ended in 1988, and then for the next 23 years, Satan was in the church, and that reign, in a sense, ended May 21st, 2011, which was the beginning of judgment. However, my question is, if Satan is not in the church, where is he? Who is in the church? And why is it such a bad thing for us to attend a church? Because I think the people that are attending, at least some of the people I know, they're still wanting to hear instructions from the Bible or lessons from the Bible. So I guess if we are in the last days now, and for example, if these 1600 days are truly the last 1600 days, then who is ruling in the world, and where is Satan? Could you just clarify that, please?
Yes, yes. Thank you for those questions. They're good questions. And that is the case. You stated it correctly that the church age came to an end May 21, 1988, and God loosed Satan, and he took his seat as the man of sin and reigned in the churches for the 23-year Great Tribulation period until May 21 of 2011, and then the Great Tribulation ended, and the judgment of God shifted, or to put it another way, expanded from exclusively upon the church to now include the whole world, and the churches are still under that judgment. So the judgment of God remains upon them. But Satan was put down from rule. He was given to rule in the congregations for 42 months, it says in the book of Revelation, and that's just a figure of speech or a number to represent the duration of the Great Tribulation. And so the Great Tribulation is concluded, so has Satan's rule. And now Christ was victorious on May 21 and removed Satan from rule in the world and in the church, because when we read, for instance, in Revelation 13 of the beast coming out of the sea and a second beast in the earth, these two beasts were pointing to Satan's Satan being given a tremendous reign over the church and the world. And when the Great Tribulation came to a close, well, then God ended both reigns of Satan, and the Lord Jesus became victorious and is the one reigning supreme over all. But Satan still exists. He still exists. He still is in the world, and yet he does not have any official authority over the church or over anything, yet he still may go into the churches just as he did throughout the church age. We read in the book of Revelation in chapter 2 that God refers to the synagogue of Satan. And so Satan was active in the churches throughout the entire church age. He was busy sowing tares amongst the wheat. And so he's active in the church today, but he's not ruling. He didn't have that official capacity during the church age, and he doesn't have it today. God removed the authority that he had given him to destroy the church while they were under the judgment of God. And so we do not want to go back to the church, because the church has become the image of the beast. It was that's also found in Revelation 13. God likens the churches to the image of the beast, and that image remains, and God is not dwelling in the midst of the congregations to bless the churches. No one is being saved there. And besides that, God commanded us to come out of the church, and that command will never be rescinded. You know, we might as well say, well, why don't we go back to a synagogue? The synagogues aren't actively under the judgment of God anymore. When God rent the veil of the temple, he divorced national Israel back in 33 AD. Well, why would anyone ever want to go back to a synagogue? There's nothing there. There's no value, no spiritual benefit in any synagogue, and there's no spiritual benefit in any church. But it would be an indicator that we're looking back. It would be an indicator that we're not learning the lesson of Lot's wife, who looked behind her. And so there is no good in any way in returning to a church.
Mm-hmm. So right now you're saying as of May 21st, 2011, that Christ is ruling in the world, ruling in the entire world, but Satan still has influence?
Christ is officially, he won the victory over the kingdom of darkness, over Satan's kingdom, when he completed his salvation plan and he saved the last of the elect. When the last of the captives were delivered out of the dungeons of darkness, and when all whose names were written were rescued from their sin and released and freed, well, then the Lord Jesus won the victory. He won the war. The war raged for centuries as Christ went forth to find his sheep and Satan attempted to prevent them from being found. Christ went forth to deliver them and Satan fought to make sure they weren't delivered. And now that battle has come to an end. It's not going on anymore. And so the whole purpose that God raised up Satan was accomplished. And so he just simply stopped using him and put him down. He removed the same thing in the churches. He allowed Satan to rule to accomplish his own purpose, but now the purpose is accomplished. And so Satan is in the world. He's still there. He hasn't died. He's a spirit being, and there's still demons that accompany him or associate with him that go about, and they can cause trouble, but they have no official rule, no official authority any longer in the world or in the church or anywhere. And look at it in the sense of the book of Esther, where we have Haman, who is a picture of Satan. He's called the adversary of the Jews. And we have Haman's 10 sons. And on one day, Haman is hanged, yet his 10 sons continue to live until the very last day of that period when they was chosen by Lot. And that's the idea that that Satan, in a sense, is killed, only that he lost this authority and rule. But he continues to exist as Haman's 10 sons continue to live until the very end, and then he'll be destroyed literally forever as God just destroys his being.
So then this period that we are living in now, this last 1600 days, if this is true, is just, Satan can no longer acquire any more, he can't acquire any more souls, and the Lord isn't acquiring any more souls. So this is just a period of inactivity, in a sense, where we just are to hunker down.
Well, you have the idea, because remember the verse in Revelation 22, the righteous will be righteous still, and the filthy will be filthy still. And that's basically what you just said, that all those in God's kingdom will remain in God's kingdom and none will be added, and all those that are in Satan's kingdom cannot come out. Yes, no more changing. God will not apply salvation to anyone else in the kingdom of Satan. That's finished. And so, but this is an inactivity. This is a very active period of time spiritually, because God is judging the world, and it's a spiritual judgment. And so that's taking place. And at the same time, God is trying those that are his people for the 1600 days, which looks like that will be the duration of the day of judgment. And when we look at that number 1600 closely, we find that it breaks down into 40 times 40. And 40 is the number of testing. And so the Lord in giving us that number is really revealing his plan to bring about a most severe time of testing for the people of God. And you can also look in a historical type into the book of Daniel as the Babylonian period, the 70-year period when Judah was under Babylonian captivity, came to an end. And it was on a night when the king of Babylon was having a banquet of wine, and he saw writing on the wall. And then Daniel was called to interpret the writing, and it was found that the kingdom was divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And that very night, the Medes and the Persians, King Darius, took the kingdom. And that was the end of the 70-year period, which in turn pictures the end of the Great Tribulation. All right, now the evil king of Babylon is dead in that historical picture. And the king of Babylon represents Satan. And the good king, Darius, has taken the kingdom. So now we would expect everything will go just wonderfully for Daniel and for the true believers, because it seems that way when we begin reading Daniel chapter 6, as Darius likes Daniel. He recognizes he's a good man and a faithful man, and so everything seems fine. And Darius, whose name is also Cyrus, is used in the Bible as a picture of Christ. Isaiah 45 verse 1 calls him the Lord's anointed. And so here, Darius Christ has taken the kingdom, and we would expect, well, now it's all going to be wonderful and beautiful. But what happens in Daniel chapter 6? Does everything go swimmingly? Everything go easily for Daniel? No, actually, Daniel is put through the most severe test that he has ever gone through previously. And he's gone through a lot in Babylon. But after the king of Babylon is killed, after the Babylonians are defeated, Daniel is thrown into a den of lions. And yet the king of the Medes and the Persians was favorable to Daniel. He looked kindly upon Daniel. He didn't want to do that, but it was necessary. And that's exactly parallels our present situation. At the end of the Great Tribulation, all right, Satan is put down. His kingdom is defeated. Christ is victorious. He's the one reigning in the world and everywhere. And, of course, he looks favorable to his people, to the elect. Yet here we are, going through a very severe time of testing. It matches almost perfectly with the historical account in the book of Daniel.
So you're saying then what we have to expect right now as believers is just severe testing for in each of these 40-day periods? Or?
Well, the 40 times 40 is just God's way of emphasizing a truth. And we could look upon it that way. We could look upon it that since May 21 of 2011, we entered into a 40-day period, and following that 40-day period will come another 40-day period, and following that a third and a fourth and a fifth until we reach 40 periods of 40 days each. And if we could look at it that way, but basically it's just telling us that this whole time, the whole time from May 21 on, we are being tested, and the test will not let up. We were tested, and I think, you know, when I first saw that number, 40 times 40, in a breakdown from the 1600, I just nodded my head and thought, well, that fits very well, and I fully understand that. I think a lot of the Lord's people fully understand that we have been tested with the way things have worked out from the very beginning of May 21. As soon as things did not happen, as soon as it became apparent they would not happen as we had thought they would, physically and literally with earthquakes and so on, well, there was an immediate tension in the air, an immediate change from all the time before. There's never been a period like this that I can ever recall, and I'm sure many of us would say the same thing. And the test continues as the world has a very low opinion of the people of God for proclaiming this. The churches, they feel they've been victorious, and they have an even lesser opinion of us. And then also part of the test is individuals that were with us have been turning and going against the teachings that they once held to, and it weakens the hands of the fellow believers and so on. It's just a very trying time all the way around.
Thank you so much for explaining this. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling and for your question. And let's go to the next person on the phone. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon question and answer. Please go ahead with your call.
Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 14 to 18. Could you explain, please?
Ecclesiastes 2?
Yes.
14 through 18?
Yes.
Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 14. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness, and I myself perceived also that one event happeneth to them all. Then said I in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me, and why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart that this also is vanity, for there is no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever, seeing that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man as the fool? Therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Yea, I hated all my labor, which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. And you, do you have a question, or just
want
to
explain, please?
Well, verse 14, the wise man's eyes are in his head. That's because God has put them there, that he has given spiritual sight to his people, that he has, in the spiritual realm, eyes are eyes of understanding. He has enlightened the minds of the elect to understand the spiritual truths of the Bible. But on the other hand, the fool walketh in darkness. So the fool has not been given spiritual eyes to see, and so they do not understand spiritual things. And this can range from not understanding or believing there is a God to maybe acknowledging that, but then not understanding the actual teachings of God in the Bible. They approach the Bible in a earthly way, in a natural way, and they don't comprehend the deeper spiritual things of God, and so it's due to the darkness that they're in. When people sin, they enter into darkness. When mankind sinned in the Garden of Eden, we lost that connection with God that enlightened us, and it left us spiritually dark. Or another way of saying it is spiritually dead. And it takes an act of God's grace and mercy to grant us salvation, to reconnect us, to give us a new birth, so that we can be enlightened once again by the Spirit of God. And so that's the situation of mankind. There's the wise and the foolish in the world. And then it goes on to say, well, it's speaking of one event happening to all. As it happened to the fool, it happens to the wise. And remember that the Bible speaks of God sending the rain on the just and the unjust. And so that's true. God does give blessings to unjust as well as just people, those that are saved and those that are unsaved. It's all the work of God. And there is no more remembrance of the wise than the fool, and all shall be forgotten. Well, that would relate to the things of this world no longer being remembered.
Does it mean that Solomon recognized that he's not a saved man, is not going to be saved?
Oh, I'm not sure. Verse 16. There is no more remembrance of the wise. Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if we can, we can get a feel for Solomon through these verses and his spiritual state. We do learn his condition in other places. And let me read this, because I wanted to mention it earlier, a verse that helps us to understand Solomon's condition is in 1 Kings 11, verse 4. For it came to pass, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with Jehovah his God, as was the heart of David his father. So that kind of verse gives us an indicator of Solomon's spiritual condition, but I'm not sure about these verses in Ecclesiastes.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question and bringing up this passage. Let's go to the next person on the phone. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon question and answer. Please go ahead with your call.
Hi, Chris. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well. Please go ahead.
Okay, just a quick comment on that verses in 2 Kings that you were looking at. That if we look at the fire being the test, then the three groups of 50, actually, they all three went through the fire, and the test was to determine how you would present yourself before the man of God. Would you present yourself with your own strength, which the first two did, and that was a failure, or would you come humbly before the man of God, which is how they passed the test? And the test, the fire was also the judgment, and it came down and burned up the first two. But the third group we can see went through the fire as if we look at the fire as being a test. Is that okay?
Well, excuse me. How I've understood, now we do see the one-third, two-third relationship here. I don't know if it's necessary for us to carry over the idea of the fire from Zechariah to here. We do see that the two groups of captains and his 50 were burned up. And we also see their, you mentioned humility. Well, we see their lack of humility because they came demanding of, who is it, Elijah? Or, they came demanding of Elijah that he come down. It says in verse 9, then the king sent unto him a captain of 50 with his 50, and he went up to him. And behold, he sat on the top of a hill, and he spake unto him, thou man of God, the king has said, come down. It is an order, it's a command, and this captain, he's just following his orders from the king. And of course, naturally he thinks, well, everyone must obey the king of Israel. And so he gives the order, and then the next thing you know, him and his 50 are burned up. Well, look at the second captain in verse 11. Again, also he sent unto him another captain of 50 with his 50, and he answered and said unto him, O man of God, thus has the king said, come down quickly. Again, they're ordering Elijah, the man of God, the prophet, to, here's what you're to do. You come down and you come to the king. And remember, the king was injured, and certainly he wanted to be healed. And so I've seen this as a God giving us a big notice of how to approach him for salvation and how not to. And we do not command God. We don't say, well, I accept you today, and as if God had no say about it, and we're the one giving the orders to God in the matter of salvation. Now, that leads to being burned up. But the third captain learns his lesson, and he comes very humbly. He says at the end of verse 13, O man of God, I pray thee, let my life and the life of these 50 thy servants be precious in thy sight. You notice he didn't give any order. He didn't even say come down at all. He's just pleading for his life. And then God says, don't be afraid of him, go down. And so it's a lesson to everyone in the days when we were to approach God, to boldly seek his throne, to go unto him, that he might spare us and heal us from our sin sickness, that we needed to do that very humbly and in a very lowly way, like that third captain.
Okay, I was just wanting to make a comment on that. But anyway, my real question is to compare some verses, Revelation 6, verses 15 through 17, mm-hmm. and compare that to Isaiah 2:19-22. So Revelation 6:15-17.
Revelation 6, beginning in verse 15. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman, and every free man, hid themselves in the dens, and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? And Isaiah 2?
Verses 19-22.
And they shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth for fear of Jehovah and for the glory of his majesty when he ariseth to shake terribly the earth. In that day a man shall cast his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which they made each one for himself to worship, to the moles and to the bats, to go into the clefts of the rocks and into the tops of the ragged rocks, for fear of Jehovah and for the glory of his majesty, when he ariseth to shake terribly the earth. Cease ye from man whose breath is in his nostrils, for wherein is he to be accounted of?
Now, we've always assumed that that the verses in Revelation are pointing to unsaved man, but now we're learning so much more, and sometimes we're seeing things differently. Do you see any connection between these two sets of verses, and is it possible we may have understood those verses in Revelation incorrectly in the past?
There seems to be a similarity, but Revelation 6, where it speaks of the kings of the earth and the great men and the rich men, when we look up those groups, it seems pretty clearly to point to unsaved people.
Yeah, but then it says every free man. Who's a free man?
Well, yeah, but, you know, God often uses that figure, bond or free. And he recognizes there were servants or slaves, and there were individuals that were not servants or slaves. That doesn't necessarily mean it's referring to a saved man.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I was just curious if maybe you thought that we might have had that wrong. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for those passages. And let's go to the next person on the phone. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon question and answer. Please go ahead with your call.
Hi, Chris. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, very well. Please go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, just a couple of things with regard to a couple of calls ago, and that not only is it a time of fire and testing for us, but also I think God is making it more and more clear that we got to feed sheep, and also Satan is getting more souls in the sense that every new baby that's born has no possibility of becoming saved. So in that sense, more are being added to the kingdom of Satan. But Mike, I was wondering if you could, with regard to feeding sheep, go over again what you had talked about on Friday's question and answer. I think there's a lot more people here, and I this is the first I've heard of this, where Matthew 14 and the feeding of the 5,000, if you could go over that again and how it relates to Revelation 10.
Sure. I'll go over Matthew 14. In Matthew 14, we find, let me read a couple of verses that'll set up the feeding of the great multitude. It says in verse 13, when Jesus heard of it, he departed thence by ship into a desert place apart. And when the people had heard thereof, they followed him on foot out of the cities. And Jesus went forth and saw a great multitude. Now, those are the same two Greek words that are in Revelation 7, where we read of that great multitude that came out of great tribulation. And so that's something that interests us, and we just want to keep that in mind, that this is speaking of a great multitude. And it goes on to say, and was moved with compassion toward them, and he healed their sick. So Christ encountered a great multitude, and out of compassion he healed them. And we know that the healings of the infirmed and sick point to salvation. They were acts of Christ, really word pictures or parables to teach salvation. And so he spent the day healing a great multitude. And then in verse 15, and when it was evening, now this reminds us of Matthew 20, verse 8, that speaks of the 12-hour workday and then says when even was come. And this is the same word. Even there was 6 p.m. It's the end of the workday. And so this is the end of the day in which the Lord Jesus spent healing. It's the end of that day of healing a great multitude. And so it was evening. His disciples came to him saying, this is a desert place and the time is now past. Now the word time is the Greek word ora, that's translated as hour. And that again seems to fit with what we know of the great tribulation period, as God refers to it as a period of 1 hour. And now the hour is past. And here's a great multitude that were healed, and yet now the time of Christ's work of healing has come to a close. We know historically, it's just speaking of that day, but spiritually, it appears to be pointing to the end of the day of salvation. And so the disciples say, send the multitude away that they may go into the villages and buy themselves victuals. You know, this really reminds me of all kinds of people saying, just leave everybody themselves and God, everybody with their Bible and God. Just leave everyone alone, really, and let everyone find their own food, is really what that's saying. And the disciples are saying that, look, there's a great multitude here. Send them away. Let them go fend for themselves. In verse 16, but Jesus said unto them, they need not depart. Give ye them to eat. So Christ is speaking to his disciples. And we don't know if it's just the 12 apostles or others. Other disciples followed along. But whoever was with him, he's speaking to them. And he's telling them, give ye them to eat. And they say unto him in verse 17, we have here but 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And in one of the other accounts, it said, well, what is that to feed such a multitude? And the 5 loaves and 2 fishes, and later we'll find the number of men were 5,000 beside women and children. That is, plus there were women and children. And so there were many more than 5,000. And how can you feed a great multitude with 5 loaves and just 2 little fishes? It's impossible. And anyone who has visited our fellowship, when we have just about 100 or 150 people there, you know, it takes a lot more food than that. If we just put 5 loaves on the table, it wouldn't be much food at all. And it's Christ's plan not only to give these people bread, but not just a little bit. He wants them to eat and be filled. So it's a satisfying, nourishing meal. And he goes on to multiply the bread and the fishes. And it says in verse 19, and he commanded the multitude to sit down on the grass and took the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and brake and gave the loaves to his disciples and the disciples to the multitude, and they did all eat and were filled, and they took up the fragments that remained 12 baskets full. And in this passage, I think the Lord is directing us on what we are to do at this time of evening, when the day of salvation has come to a close. Feeding these people bread, it is synonymous with feeding sheep idea that Christ said to Peter, feed my sheep. And when we look at a great multitude that's out there in the world, we immediately think to ourselves, well, we don't have the sufficient means to find them, to feed them the gospel. We have limited resources. That's immediately what I think, and I'm sure it's what you think. How can E-Bible Fellowship, an internet ministry, doesn't even have a radio station, not even one, let alone a network, how can an internet ministry feed so many that became saved, such a great multitude? And I think here the Lord is laying out the design of God for how we're to do this. We are to feed little groups. He makes them to sit down on the grass. In another of the parallel passages, it says in companies of 50 or 100, and he gave the loaves to disciples, and he gave the disciples to the multitude. So the Lord is feeding us first. He's teaching us truth, and he wants us now to share it with everyone we can. But, you know, some people think that what can I do? Well, you could open up a website. And then the next thought is, yeah, I could. Websites are free today. Or a blog, I could do that. And I could post these things and links and things, yeah. And I can tell people we're in the day of judgment. I can do those things. But you know what? If I do that, how many people are going to visit my site? Let's be realistic. 50, 75, 100 people, most. And maybe 200. And, well, okay, then that's exactly what Christ is saying, that we take the truth that we heard, and we take the bread that he has broken, and we go feed our little group of 50, 75, 100 people. And we keep praying, and the Lord keeps moving in the hearts of others, that they then in turn feed their little group. Or we could put it on our Facebook page or on our Yahoo group or whatever, Pal Talk. There's so many different ways we can feed little groups. And this seems to be the methodology that God is revealing to us on how the great multitude is going to be fed. It is impossible, let me say that, for this to happen. Based on our efforts, we can't do it. We can't take 5 loaves of bread and feed 5,000, but it's only if it's the will of God, and he can do it. If he did it, and he did, historically in this instance, he can do it spiritually. We certainly know how God can work, and he can accomplish his purpose.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
Well, thank you for your question and bringing up this passage. Let's go to the next person on the phone. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon question and answer. Please, go ahead with your call.
Yes, good afternoon, Chris. I lost you on the previous call because, I don't know, I just didn't hear anything, and then I hung up and I was out of the K. So, but I asked you about the Second Kings, and the more I look at the verses in front of the First Kings, verses I asked you to look at, it seems that it's also a test of obedience. Are we going to obey God or are we going to obey Satan? And because that one, the king who fell through the lattice, was asked men to summon up from another god. So, you know, they in the verses in front of that, that's I think it's a kind of a test to see if we're going to go back to the churches, or if we're going to go back to if the elect are going to, once they're saved from Satan's reign, whether they're going to go back to that. And that's the test to see if we're going to go back to the churches where the beast is, the image of the beast is worshipped, or if we're going to go back to the world where it's always been worshipped because we were saved out of the bondage of both things. So the test for the believers, which is 153, that were saved during this great tribulation in the latter rain period would be to see whether we're going to go back to the old teachings or business as usual or the old churches or anything of that sort, if we're going to go back to that. If we are, then we're not saved. We're giving an indication that we're not saved. Is that correct, you think?
Well, I don't know if we can see that in the Second Kings 1 account. What you're saying is true. As far as this period of time, there is a test. And part of the test is, are we going to go back to the world? And some people have. Or are we going to go back to the church? And some people have already. There's also the test, are we going to go back to old doctrine? Because some people, when they throw off the calendar of history, they soon realize, well, now I don't have support for the end of the church age and these other things. And you know, when the mind begins to doubt a truth of God, and it begins to continue in that line of thinking, then it doubts more and more. And I think that would one of the reasons why God says that that which they have will be taken away from them, and so they could go back to the doctrine of Christ atoning for sins in 33 AD. They can return to the doctrine of hell. They can return to all kinds of teachings that we learn since the Lord opened up the book in the time of the Great Tribulation. And so you don't have to go anywhere necessarily. You can still be an individual who is outside of the church and still religious and still in your Bible, but you could have gone back in mind to former doctrines, and you're failing the test.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention was that on the line to the last previous caller about feeding sheep, is I wanted to thank someone, Ezekiel, for posting a new bumper sticker, Boldness in the Day of Judgment. And I was able to go to a local T-shirt making place, and they were able to download the image from a flash drive, and I was able to put it on a T-shirt. So I'm starting already to put it on shirts and so forth. So I think the websites are a very good idea because they're free, and they're also kind of echo, you know, they add a little bit more, numbers, because I'm looking at this, Luke chapter 11, verse 5 through 8 again.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember those about the midnight where the three loaves of bread were asked for, and because of the importunity of the gentleman, of the man, that's why he was given those things. And we're in the midnight time, and we're not just praying for those we don't know if God has saved from before the foundation of the world, but we could also pray that we're feeding sheep with those bread, right? In other words, we could also ask for bread in the nighttime because we need to also keep each other sustained spiritually.
Well, yes, I'm glad that you were able to get the image and make up a shirt. We do not yet have those bumper stickers available. We have to order them and wait for them to arrive. But we do hope to get that new sticker. It says Boldness in the Day of Judgment, 1 John 4:17, and then the e-Bible site, and it looks pretty nice with an image of the world. We also would like to have some t-shirts made and things like that, to do whatever we can do. But to develop a website or a blog would be very helpful. And, you know, today with Google Translator, someone can say, you know what, I want to feed sheep in Nepal and learn whatever language, Nepalese, I suppose, whatever language they speak, and translate their particular site into that one target language. And it could be that a couple of elect from that place find it. Or we could pick any language in the world today. And I know the Google Translator isn't perfect, but if it's the only thing we can do, well, we can't wait for perfection. We have to say, okay, now let me take another language and let me target Tonga or whatever. And we could begin to attempt to reach out to every nation of the world, and each individual, it doesn't take a whole translation department. Any one of us could do this. I would probably struggle with the website part. I'm not all that technical. I'm sure some others would struggle, but we can also help one another. There's individuals that are more capable in technical areas, and they could help us, and we could develop websites in English or any language practically in the world.
I'm working on one that has a where I can post something every day, like a study, a link to your one of your studies on the Bible, and then followed by the second section would be a brief commentary, and another would be where others could also comment on them. So in other words, it's kind of like three things in there that somebody could look at: verses from the studies, and then maybe a link to a previous study, and then maybe a little blog at the end, you know, so for people to visit or make a comment or something like that. We could call it breaking bread or feeding sheep or something along those lines, where you know, where people who are looking for such things are able to access them.
Yes, and you know, just think of how God can work and has worked with a radio station, and that always used to amaze me that's how I began to listen to family radio, just playing with the radio dial and coming across it. And I've heard that from many, many people. Now, when we're talking about internet, that's like that the radio dial idea multiplied 100,000 times, because there's so many websites. Yet the more websites we can put out there, and if they're becoming sort of a web connected to one another through links and so forth, then we're just multiplying that opportunity for God to work in directing individuals that he would have to find these things. And he's very capable of doing that in the internet world as much as he is on a radio dial. But thank you once again, and for your call and comments. And let's go to the next person on the phone. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon question and answer. Please go ahead with your call.
This is an email question regarding 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 24. Is it possible that the word power in this verse is referring to the gospel, and that it was put down in a way that it does not save any longer?
Well, let me read the verse. Then cometh the end. Well, I'll begin reading verse 23. But every man in his own order, Christ the firstfruits, afterward they that are Christ at his coming. Then cometh the end, when he shall have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father, when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power. Well, I don't know. I do know that when Matthew 24 speaks of the powers in the heavens shall be shaken, that it is referring to spiritually the power of the gospel to save will be removed. We can know that, for instance, because the word powers there in Matthew 24:29 is found in Romans 1:16, where God says the gospel is the power of God unto salvation. So God makes that connection with the word power to salvation. Also, 1 Corinthians 1:18 speaks of the preaching of the cross is the power of God, and so it is that power more especially identified with salvation that has been shaken in the day of judgment at this time. And it's possible that could be in view, but I'd have to look at everything the verse was saying to make sure that idea fit. But thank you for your thoughts and for your question. And let's go to the next person on the phone. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon question and answer. Please go ahead with your call.
Good afternoon, Chris. I have a question in John 20, verses 19 through 29.
John 20,
verses
through 29?
Yeah, it's a lot of reading.
That's a lot to read. Is there anything in it? It's getting kind of late in the program. Is there anything in particular?
Yes. When the Lord appeared to the disciples, and the Bible talks about the doors being shut, and then he appeared to the disciples, then he gave them the spirit to go out. And then we have Thomas, who had doubt, and then he wished to see the wounds that the Lord had received, and then he saw it and he believed. My point is, I was trying to see if this is really speaking of today, of those who are slow to come to the realization that we're in the day of judgment, and those who were walking with us previously, and they have, you know, they are saved, just that they are slow coming to the realization. And I also wanted to link that up to the fact that God told us that he will speak to us in 1 Corinthians 13 face to face, which is, I believe, is this time through his word we are understanding the meat of the gospel. And I was drawing reference, you know, last Friday I brought up Mr. Campbell. And I've been listening on and off, not as much as I used to, but in recent time I've heard Mr. Campin teaching, and I think Mr. Campin is going along on your page, encouraging people to read the Bible and understand that the Bible is showing new things, and we cannot hold on to the things we've understood in the past alone, but we have to be open. And I was very encouraged by that. So I just wanted to know if that scripture kind of paints a picture of that.
This passage in John?
Yeah.
John 20?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if we can tie it in to our time. We can take the principle that we see here, and we do know that Thomas didn't believe unless he had seen the Lord, and so God is definitely giving that principle that that we need to believe without seeing, and that's a principle that applies to many different areas and would also apply to this day of judgment as we've entered judgment day that cannot be seen. It's invisible, and some were expecting something very visible. We all were, but some refused to acknowledge the possibility of an invisible day of judgment, of a spiritual judgment, despite the fact the Bible has many historical precedents in the Garden of Eden or Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane or the judgment on the churches and congregations. They're all spiritual invisible judgments, and God has just followed suit and continued to give the cup of his wrath in a spiritual way, and now he's done this to the world. And I don't know, as far as some believing and some not believing, yes, we continue to have hope that people might come around, that maybe in due time, in God's timetable for certain ones, that they will begin to understand. I think a good example is the end of the church age. And there were people who didn't see it, who didn't leave their church for year after year after year. And then next thing you know, well, there they are at a family radio conference, or there they are on a mission trip, and you talk to them, and they said, "Yeah, I just one day I was reading this verse and it struck me, and God is able to do that. And so we can continue to pray for others and just be patient with them, knowing that the Lord has his own timetable, and it could be that before this period of time is up, they will also begin to understand what God has done.
One more question, Chris. An idea of a bumper sticker. Can one be constructed stating the day of judgment consists of 1,600 days, and you know, somewhere in there you use the math, you know, the 40 times 40. It's been bumping around in my head for quite a while now.
Well, I don't know. We'll have to see as we go on. There's nothing to stop us from doing several different kinds and types, and so we'll see if it's possible to do something with 1,600 days. But right now we just have the two, living in the day of judgment, and we don't even have the second one yet. We're going to have to wait for that to come in, and boldness in the day of judgment. But we'll see if we are able to develop more. But thank you for your question and for bringing up those verses. And let's go to the next person on the phone, and this will be our last caller today. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon question and answer. Please go ahead with your call.
Yes. Could you look at Psalm 116, 12 to 14?
Psalm 116, beginning in verse 12. 12 through 14.
Yes, please.
What shall I render unto Jehovah for all his benefits toward me? I will take the cup of salvation and call upon the name of Jehovah. I will pay my vows unto Jehovah now in the presence of all his people.
And Psalm 56, 12.
Psalm 56, verse 12. Thy vows are upon me, O God. I will render praises unto thee.
I'm sorry, I meant Psalm 61, 5 and 8.
Psalm 61. That's okay. Verse 5. For thou, O God, hast heard my vows. Thou hast given me the heritage of those that fear thy name. Verse 8. So I sing praise unto thy name forever, that I may daily perform my vows.
I feel like I'm being severely tested, and hopefully I'm being purged. I know there's nothing I can do. I'm wondering, how can I perform my daily vows to the Lord?
Well,
what are my vows? And
yeah. When we read of vows, often we find that Christ took a vow. In Jonah, it says, if I can find that book. See, Jonah chapter 2, when Jonah was in the whale's belly, it says in verse 9, but I will sacrifice unto thee with the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay that I have vowed. Salvation is of Jehovah. Now, Jonah is a type of Christ. And so this verse is revealing to us that Christ made a vow to bring salvation to his people, and he performed that vow. Now, we really shouldn't be thinking of vows or of making vows to God, you know, like people do around the new year. Well, this year I vow I'm not going to eat these kinds of foods, or I'm going to exercise, or some people vow to stop smoking or to stop drinking, and so they're making vows, and that's not really what we want to do. You know, the number one, a vow tends to put all kinds of future pressure upon us today. Mm-hmm. You know, when someone says, I quit for the rest of this year, or I'm not going to do it any longer. Well, now they're trying to quit for a long period of time, when really all they have to do is today. And the Bible warns us, you know, the AA slogan, I used to know that by heart. One day at a time. That's really taken from the Bible, when the Bible says sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. So all we have to concern ourselves with is today, and we want to do things God's way today. And so we begin by praying, oh Lord, in the beginning of the day, help me to do it your way. Here's the areas where I'm having trouble. Here's where I'm failing. Here's where I have trouble with other people. That we can go to God with the whole day. Normally, especially when we get older, we can almost anticipate a day's troubles or a day's evils. And we can go to God. We can go back to him at lunch and pray some more. And we, or throughout the day as necessary. And that's daily taking up our cross. But yes, Jesus said, whoever will follow me, take up your cross. But in another place it says daily. And that's all we have to concern ourselves with, is just today. And that will bring a lot of relief, because we're not thinking, well, I have to, give something up for 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years. It's only today. And that's when we start, and we try to live to the glory of God today. And then tomorrow we start again. And again, it's sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. And we just ask God for help. And we clearly admit our weakness, our inability, and we're asking God for his strength. And there's so many verses in the Bible that God speaks of his strength. And one place he says that he delights in showing himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is perfect towards him, on behalf of his elect individual. He wants to show himself strong. And so we can give him that opportunity when we turn to him in prayer and we cry out for help.
Okay. That was a big help. And so was your study today. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for those verses and for your question. I would like to thank everyone for sharing your questions and your comments, and especially for the Bible verses we had an opportunity to read and consider. But for now, I'm going to say, may you have a good afternoon, and turn it back over to Michael.
And thank you for joining us here on eBible Fellowship Sunday Afternoon Questions and Answers Time. You can hear this broadcast each and every Sunday around 1 o'clock Eastern. And don't forget, you can also join us for yet another live Questions and Answers Time Friday evenings at about 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Until then, have a pleasant Sunday afternoon, and may the Lord's perfect will be done.